Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program here at CSIS. On behalf of CSIS and the Inter-American Dialogue, I'm delighted to welcome you to this presentation by His Excellency Leonel Fernandez, President of the Dominican Republic. Mr. President, it's an honor and a privilege to have you here. Today's large and enthusiastic audience bears witness to your leadership and to the strength of the friendship between the United States and the Dominican Republic. We're delighted that you could be with us this morning. We thank you for your generosity and in giving us your time. I would also like to give a very special welcome to His Excellency Flavio Arillo Espinal, Ambassador of the Dominican Republic to the United States, and His Excellency Hans Hertel, U.S. Ambassador to the Dominican Republic. I also wish to recognize the presence of the distinguished members of President Fernandez's delegation, of our friends from the Embassy of the Dominican Republic, to other ambassadors in attendance. Welcome to all of our guests. There were many people who assisted in the planning and preparation of today's event. In this regard, I would like to extend special thanks to Natasha Despotovic, Executive Director of the Global Foundation for Democracy and Development, and to Johanna Mendelson-Forman, Senior Associate of CSIS. It is now my pleasure to invite my friend Michael Shifter, Vice President of Inter-American Dialogue, to the podium.
Thank you very much, Peter. I first met President Fernandez in 1995 here in Washington, D.C., and he told me at that time two things. First, he intended to run for president of the Dominican Republic, and also he was interested in being a member of the Inter-American Dialogue. I wished him well. I told them both were very noble goals, but I told them it would not be possible to be a member of the Dialogue and at the same time hold national office. So this, of course, posed a tough decision, whether to become a member of the Dialogue or run for president of the Dominican Republic. Of course, as we know, he ran and won. With that election in 1996, there was a changing of the guard of the Dominican Republic. With President Fernandez, the torch had been passed to a new generation of leaders. President Fernandez had a superb background to be president. He's had vast political experience dating from 1973 when he joined the Dominican Liberation Party. He's held very high positions in the party. He was trained as a lawyer and benefited from the best education, even attending New York City public schools. And he hasn't lost his New York accent, which I'm delighted to note. He also became a leading intellectual and a scholar, wrote several books, including The U.S. in the Caribbean. Maybe he'll write an update now, the U.S. and Caribbean, to that book. President Fernandez's first term was a great success. Dominican Republic had among the highest growth rates in the world, almost 8% during his first term. There were major reforms that were advanced, and President Fernandez established himself as a statesman. In 2000, upon leaving the presidency, he was then able to fulfill his second goal. He became a member of the Inter-American Dialogue, but he also became active in other institutions, including CSIS, Club de Madrid, and many others. Also building on his positive record as president, he founded the Global Foundation for Development and Democracy, which is co-sponsoring this event. In 2004, President Fernandez returned to the presidency, winning handily in the first round. As we know, in Latin America, second terms, the record of second-term presidents has not been too encouraging, but so far, at least, it looks like that President Fernandez could defy that and overcome that curse of the second term. Not only has he been a successful leader of the Dominican Republic, but also a leader at the regional and international level in all the summits and fora. I have seen President Fernandez being referred to as an example of the move to the left in Latin America and also referred to as a neoliberal. Perhaps more than any other leader I know, he exemplifies the problem with using such artificial labels. President Fernandez is just committed to taking advantage of globalization, economic growth, social and institutional reform, and reducing poverty. In short, he is committed to making a better life for the citizens of the Dominican Republic. It is my great honor and privilege to present to you His Excellency President Leonel Fernandez.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mike, for such a warm introduction and for reminding me about that tough choice I had to make being president of the Dominican Republic or a member of the Inter-American Dialogue. But I must recall that you also told me that the problem was that all those who aspired to be members of the Inter-American Dialogue were losing elections in Latin America. So the choice was easy at the time. Thank you, Mike, for your invitation here on behalf of the Inter-American Dialogue. And Peter, thank you also for arranging this meeting on behalf of the CSIS. And I want to acknowledge the presence of the Dominican delegation that has accompanied me here today, of the Dominican ambassador here in Washington, Flavio Darío Espinel, the U.S. ambassador in the Dominican Republic, Hans Hertel, the OAS representative of the Dominican Republic, also here with us, as well as the Undersecretary General of the OAS. And to many of you, dear friends, from many years ago, as Professor Howard Riarda, who has surprised me here with his presence today. He is the leading expert on Dominican affairs, from whom I have learned so much over the years about my own country. So thank you, Howard, for being here today, as well as to all of you who have taken your time and your energy to share with us some thoughts about current events in the Dominican Republic. And perhaps I should start by referring to the meeting I had yesterday with President Bush, because I think it brings us up to date about the Dominican Republic and its future. And I would say the main topic that I discussed with President Bush yesterday related to DR-CAFTA. And it's the culmination of a whole process of economic development in the Dominican Republic. We are at the final stage now of implementing DR-CAFTA for the Dominican Republic. As you all know, for over two decades, the Dominican Republic had benefited from the CBI program, the Caribbean Basin Initiative program, which is in some way free trade, but unilaterally. It was exports from the Dominican Republic into the U.S. market. Now, the free trade agreement creates a reciprocal trade agreement, which means that the Dominican economy should now open to the import of goods and services coming from the U.S. So this will create a benefit for the U.S. economy that wasn't there through the CBI program. But for the Dominican Republic, it guarantees permanent access to the U.S. market. And this is a big plus for an economy, for an emerging economy like the Dominican Republic, that can guarantee a permanent access on a duty-free basis into the U.S. economy, especially when 85% of our exports are already coming into the U.S. economy. So it means a lot in terms of guaranteeing this access and also attracting new foreign direct investment, much of which will come from the U.S. itself, but also from other parts of the world, especially from Asia, where we're promoting foreign direct investments into the Dominican Republic and Europe, because they will benefit from the geographical location in the Dominican Republic that will become a gateway, at least into the eastern seaboard of the U.S. market. So DR-CAFTA is the culmination of a transition that the Dominican Republic has been experiencing over the last 40 years. And if you allow me, I would like to focus on these trends, these transitional trends that have been taking place in the Dominican Republic for over four decades after Trujillo's death, and that are somehow defining the role of the Dominican Republic in current events. Referring specifically to the economic side, I would say that one major transition has been the Dominican Republic, as the rest of the Latin American countries, was dependable on agricultural products, the exports of agricultural products, specifically sugar, coffee, tobacco, etc. So most of our hard earnings were obtained through agricultural exports over the years. Now, since the 70s, and more specifically since the 80s, there has been a major transformation from an agricultural export-led economy into a more services-oriented economy. So we moved from sugar and tobacco and coffee more into tourism and more into free trade zones through the CBI program. This was a major transformation in the Dominican economy, moving from agriculture into a service-oriented economy. But because of that, also the Dominican Republic made a change, made a transformation from a closed economy into a more open, liberalized economy. We went from a protectionist economy into a more global integrated economy. And what I mean protectionist is that there was at some point the possibility of making a transition from an agricultural-based economy into a domestic industrial economy. And the way to do this was by protecting local manufacturing. But unfortunately, industrialization did not develop in the Dominican Republic. Still, an underdeveloped local domestic industry. And so, instead of moving from an agricultural-led export economy, we went directly into a service-oriented economy. And the industrialization process was more export-oriented through the free trade zones or the partnership sharing mechanism that we used for the maquila system. So there was a major transformation there in the Dominican economy. Also, we went from state-owned enterprises into capitalization and privatization. We are going from a labor-intensive economy into more capital technology-driven economy. We also are moving from an inward-looking economy. At the beginning, we're just producing for the local market, and now is more an outward-looking economy. And in terms of our fiscal policy, from more customs dependence into internal revenue dependence, which is part of the free trade that we're moving into now. So I can say these have been the major transformations that we have experienced in terms of the Dominican economy in the last four decades. But that's not all. The Dominican Republic as a society has been going through very deep and radical transformations over this period. If we look at it demographically, for example, then I see that here in the U.S. there has been a lot of interest now that you have reached the 300 million population rate. Well, in the Dominican Republic, in right after Trujillo's death in 1961, our population was 3.1 million. Nowadays, in the Dominican Republic, we have 9 million inhabitants and over a million Dominicans living abroad. So we are over 10 million people in the Dominican Republic. Now, there has also been changes in our demographics. 40 years ago, the majority of the population was living in the countryside. Nowadays, the majority of the population is living in cities, so it has become an urbanized society. But within a very complicated process of internal migration, this urbanization in the Dominican Republic took place without industrialization. So it's a very sociologically complicated situation where you have urbanization without industrialization, which has created the conditions for the emergence of the urban poor, which we didn't have before. And with the emergence of the urban poor, which is a characteristic of modern Dominican society, marginalization, which is also one of our key elements today. But also we have had the external migration, Dominicans going abroad, now creating the Dominican diaspora, which has a very important impact in the performance of the Dominican economy nowadays. With over a million Dominicans only in the U.S., which I say the majority of them legally established in the U.S., perhaps we are one of the best positioned Hispanic populations here because only between 7 and 10% of Dominicans living in the States are undocumented. So it means that it is a legally established diaspora here in the U.S. And with the remittances that are sent back home each year, it represents over 12% of our GDP. It's over $3.5 billion U.S. dollars a year. So it makes a huge contribution to the sustainability of economic performance in the Dominican Republic. So there is a major transformation about our population, increasing population, internal mobilization from the rural sector into the cities, and from Dominican Republic abroad. Now an increasing population in Europe, especially in Spain and Switzerland and Italy. So this is also a major trend in the transformation of the Dominican Republic. And with that, the emergence of the middle class that we didn't have 40 years ago. And with the emergence of the middle class, an increase in power purchasing in the Dominican Republic, the expansion of commerce, the expansion of trade, financial services, and as a whole, the expansion of the service-oriented industry in the Dominican Republic. Politically, what has happened in the last 40 years? Well, we had an authoritarian regime embodied by Trujillo. And before that, Dominican history has always been a struggle between the aspiration of a democratic system and the persistence of authoritarian tendencies. So with Trujillo's fall in 1961, there has been a new era in Dominican politics, moving from authoritarian to semi-authoritarian to, I would say, a transitional democracy that is now moving into a consolidated democracy. This has been the major trend. And right now in the Dominican Republic, we are in the midst of a major constitutional amendment whose main goal is to consolidate democracy, establish good governance, the rule of law, anti-corruption, the strengthening of the judiciary, the independence of the different powers, public powers, in the Dominican Republic, empowering the citizenship so that they would not be abused on arbitrary measures taken from the public sector. So this is a major issue right now taking place in the Dominican Republic, the constitutional amendment as part of a political institutional overhaul in the Dominican Republic to make the public sector more transparent, more accountable, more flexible, and that can guarantee a better delivery of public goods and services to the citizenry. But also, there will be major changes in terms of political parties' law. We're implementing a new law to govern the political parties, electoral reform, so that we can guarantee free, fair elections with independent members of the electoral board that can have the confidence and trust of the political parties and of the citizenship in the Dominican Republic. So major changes also in the political landscape coming from an authoritarian, undemocratic government into a more democratic, more citizenship empowerment in our country, establishing direct democratic institutions like plebiscite, referendum, consultations, and of this type. So looking into these economic, political, social transformations in the Dominican Republic, what are our major challenges today? I think we have short-term challenges and mid- and long-term challenges. When we came into office, again, in August 2004, we were in the midst of one of the most severe economic and financial crises the Dominican Republic had experienced. Unexpectedly, it happened. And I say unexpectedly because we became used to the fact that the Dominican economy has been growing over the years in a sustainable way. I would say for the last 45 years, the Dominican economy has been the most fastest sustained economic growth economy in all Latin America. 5.5% average economic growth for over 40 years. That's more than Brazil, more than Mexico, more than Chile, more than Argentina or anyone. Sustained 5.5% average economic growth over four decades indicates that there hasn't been a problem of growth in the Dominican economy. So we took it for granted that growth was there. But in the previous administration, 2000-2004, a couple of mistakes were made in terms of economic management. And I would say basically mismanagement in terms of fiscal, monetary, and exchange rate policies. Our foreign debt doubled in just 4 years, more than doubled. we had around 19-20% GDP public debt ratio. It jumped to 55% in just 4 years. We have brought it down to 41% public debt GDP ratio, and our goal is to bring it down to 25% before this term expires in 2008. So this is a major issue, the question of handling of the debt in the Dominican Republic. So with an irresponsible management of our economy, it is evidence that all macroeconomic indicators became unstable and there was a downturn in the Dominican Republic. Low economic growth, the last 2 years, minus 1.2, and when we came into office, minus 2.5 economic growth. Now, last year, we went back to 9.3 economic growth, and the projection for 2006 is that we will grow over two digits, above 10%, with low inflation, 5% for 2006, despite high oil prices. And in the year 2005, we also had low inflation, around 7%, also with high oil prices. So we are trying to, once again, stabilize the economy, control all macroeconomic indicators, and gain confidence and trust among the markets and investors. I just read last night the annual report from the IMF on the Dominican Republic, and I would like to share with you some of its findings very shortly here. But what the IMF considers has been the handling of the Dominican economy since 2004, since we came back into office in August 2004. I just quote, Dominican Republic has staged a remarkable economic turnaround since its banking crisis in 2003-2004. Large amounts of public assistance to bail out depositors and inadequate fiscal management had set off a vicious cycle of weak activity, high inflation, peso depreciation, growth of public debt, and capital flight. Upon taking office in August 2004, a new administration formulated a comprehensive program at strengthening macroeconomic policies and introducing a wide range of structural reforms. In January 2005, the IMF supported this program with a 28-month standby arrangement. Macroeconomic performance in 2005 exceeded expectations, with real GDP growing 9.3% and inflation declining to 7.4%. The consolidated fiscal balance improved by 4 percentage points of GDP, owing to expenditure cuts and a tax package approved in late 2004. Net international reserves recovered, climbing to $850 million by the end of 2005. And I'll just leave it there to give you a picture exactly of the turnaround that has been experienced in the Dominican economy. With the meeting we had the day before yesterday with the IMF authorities, our compromise is to consolidate fiscal balance in the Dominican Republic and to continue strengthening the financial institutions through scrutiny and through banking supervision so we can avoid any future banking crisis in the Dominican Republic. We will also need to work out on a new fiscal reform due to the fact that the previous one that took place at the end of 2005, October 2005, which was a fiscal reform implemented to allow the enforcement of DRCAFTA, which has meant lowering tariffs and trying to compensate the losses through internal revenues. But what has happened is a loss of income. And because of this loss of income, you cannot guarantee fiscal consolidation. So as soon as I get back home, we're going to work on a new bill just to introduce some corrections in our fiscal reform policy so we can guarantee a balanced budget and a balanced fiscal policy. And with that, we can consolidate our fiscal situation in the Dominican Republic and guarantee the continuance of trust and confidence within the markets, and the Dominican Republic will continue to strive with high economic growth, low inflation, and attracting new investments. And I think in the short term, this is our main challenge. And if we can overcome the current situation, I think there is a future path which is bright for the Dominican Republic. But we have to move even beyond this fiscal situation and this fiscal balancing in our country and more into, I would say, midterm and a long-term sustainability for our country. And there must be some additional transformation, some additional changes. For example, looking into tourism, which is one of our main pillars. Well, tourism has been more all-inclusive, massive tourism in the Dominican Republic. It has played well, but I think it will be challenged by competition in the region. And so the sustainability of our tourism has to go in a different, it has to move now in a new direction. Instead of massive, all-inclusive, it should be high-end. It should be more ecotourism, water sports. It should be more environmentally sustainable for the Dominican Republic. So I think there is a need now to move into a different type of tourism, more integrated with the communities. Up until now, it has been enclaves in the tourist resorts. It must promote authenticity, Dominican values, Dominican culture, so that people can really get a flavor of what the Dominican Republic is all about, and we can have these visitors returning to the Dominican Republic on different occasions. Free trade zones, it has played a significant role over the years, creating job opportunities for the Dominican Republic. But we cannot continue only on apparel and textiles and footwear, because that's low wages, and we need to move more into high-value products and services. The Dominican Republic is considering high-tech software industries. We have built the Santo Domingo Cyber Park to attract investments in high-tech. And I think it will create new value for the Dominican Republic, increase exports. It will identify new sources of wealth for the country, create new job opportunities, and even give it a new identity in terms of global integration, global economic integration for the Dominican Republic. So I think the main challenge is there, identifying new sources of wealth, creating more high-value-added products and services, diversifying the production, diversifying its exports destination. I think it's fine to have access to the U.S. market, but when 85% of your exports only goes to one market, I think you should consider diversifying, and we should diversify into the European market, more into Latin America. We have large imports from Latin America, but basically it's oil supplies from Mexico and Venezuela. But our exports are almost inexistent to those countries. So there is a lot of work to be done in expanding our trade relationship with the rest of the Latin American countries and with the European and Asian countries. I think one of our major challenges has to do with our social policies. Poverty is persistent in the Dominican Republic. Many people ask the question, how is it possible? Over 40 years with economic growth, and you still have a persistent poverty in the country. I think there is a lesson to be learned. Economic growth is a prerequisite for development, but it is insufficient. Economic growth does not guarantee the reduction of poverty. There needs to be deliberate social policy making oriented towards alleviating and eventually eradicating poverty. And now we're working on this in the Dominican Republic with new social safety net programs targeted at the extreme poor in the country. I think we should target some very specific indicators that will increase the welfare of the Dominican people. For example, infant mortality, still very high. We have 37 deaths per 1,000 births in the Dominican Republic. If you compare that to Cuba, 6 deaths to every 1,000 child born. Costa Rica, 8. Chile, 12. So the Dominican Republic is, in this category, well below the other Latin American nations. And if you cannot guarantee the life of your newborn, I think there is a country with a great setback there. So we have to focus on how we can reduce infant mortality in the Dominican Republic. Life expectancy, 68 years of age. If you compare it to the rest of the continent, it's over 70 years now. It's 71, 72 for the rest of the countries there. We have still malnutrition, over 20% malnutrition. We still have 18% unemployment. we still have a healthcare system that does not perform or deliver at the level it should. So the social issues, education, which is key to us, for example, 87% literate rate is an improvement from what we had before, but still high adult illiterate rates that we have to work consistently with. The quality of our education, I think there's an improvement to be made there. When we usually have debates in the Dominican Republic about the future of our education, I always insist we should focus more on developing skills oriented towards critical thinking, problem solving, English as a second language, IT literacy, civic education, value education. I think these are key elements. We have to prepare our workforce for the 21st century, for a global economy, because the only way a country can really prosper if it's able to be part of the world economy, not by isolating itself, not by looking inward. And in order to integrate within the world global economy, you need to have a workforce that is competitive, and that means training in English as a second language, because it has become the universal language of trade and diplomacy and everything. It means having access to information and communications technologies. And it means having a mindset for modernization and for integration. And so there needs to be a major overhaul in the Dominican Republic educational system. Also, increased spending. We are only spending 2.5% of our GDP in education. That's below the standard in the rest of Latin America. You may ask why. Is it lack of political will? No. It has to do with our own economic restrictions. We have to pay $2 billion a year to service the debts. We have to pay $600 million a year to sustain our deficient power electric system. So these are resources that are not going into the healthcare system or education system. And that brings us to the other challenge we have in the Dominican Republic, which is infrastructure, beginning with the power electric system. Over the years, we have been able to solve the blackouts in the Dominican Republic. And I know Caroline is here helping us through the World Bank in addressing this issue. How can we eventually eliminate subsidies for the electric power system, make it more efficient, make it more reliable? I think this is a major headache for us, one of our major challenges we have in the Dominican Republic, overcoming the unreliability of the power electric system, even though we went through a reform process, a state-owned monopoly in electricity. We unbundled the system, created generation, distribution, transmission. It has not worked. I see it has not worked even here in the U.S., just reading the New York Times from a couple of days ago. So there needs to be some strengthening of market mechanisms related to electricity. Well, these are the major challenges. And now, related to the U.S.-Dominican relationship, I think there are three major issues there. One is trade. We're moving forward with DRCAFTA. The other is migration. Dominican Republic citizens living here now in the U.S. We have adopted dual citizenship, which means that Dominicans that naturalize as U.S. citizens maintain their Dominican citizenship and are considered as such when they go back home. And the third element is security, drug trafficking, and increase in crime rate. And there needs to be more cooperation between the U.S. and the Dominican Republic in terms of security, in terms of controlling drug trafficking. This has to do with drugs coming out of Colombia, entering into Haiti into the Dominican Republic. Part of that drug is staying in the Dominican Republic, creating a new market of consumption that we didn't have before, and with that, an increase in crime rate. And part of the drug then goes into Europe and the rest to the U.S. So there is a common interest in combating drug trafficking in the Dominican Republic, between the U.S. and the Dominican Republic. So, you see, we do have short-term, mid-term, and long-term challenges in the Dominican Republic. But I would focus in three main areas. First, consolidate democracy. Second, create market mechanism for the Dominican Republic that can work. But also designing social policies that can increase the quality of life and the welfare of the people in the Dominican Republic. Thirdly, protect the environment. We should work on the sustainability of the environment in the Dominican Republic and promote high-value, export-led economy for the Dominican Republic. Respect for human rights, anti-corruption policies, transparency, accountability, the rule of law, and I think we have a great Dominican Republic for the 21st century. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Ladies and gentlemen, President Fernandez has graciously agreed to take questions from the audience. Before starting, I would like to say that when the session is over, if everyone could please remain seated until President Fernandez departs. That's a request that's been made to us. For the question and answer session, please raise your hands when you're called on. Please state your name and your affiliation. Let's start in the back. There, the microphones will come to you.
Is this working? Yes. Yes, hello. Mr. President, I'm Pablo Bachelet with the Miami Herald newspaper. As you probably know, much of the attention, the foreign policy attention in the region has been focused on the Guatemala-Venezuela race for the Security Council. I have a couple of questions on this for you. First of all, I'd like to know how the Dominican Republic has been voting on this. And if you could also say, you know, why you've been voting the way you've been voting. And second, I know that the Dominican Republic is sort of a candidate for the Security Council for the following to replace Peru, but you know this is a time when our countries are starting to move the chess pieces to become themselves sort of consensus candidates because obviously it seems that neither Guatemala nor Venezuela are in a position to get the seat. What are you doing to sort of position maybe the Dominican Republic, if anything at all, to secure sort of the support of other countries to become a candidate this time around and not 2 years down the road?
Pablo, so nice to see you again. The last time we saw each other was at the border with Haiti. So it's good to see you here in Washington. The voting at the UN Security Council is secret, so I should reveal it here, right? Secondly, I think that after 35 unsuccessful rounds, there is a need to move forward with a final solution at the UN Council. I will say publicly here that yesterday I received a phone call from the Minister of Foreign Affairs from Venezuela concerning the possibility of having the Dominican Republic step in as a consensus solution for the stalemate at the UN Council that has been taking place for the last 2 weeks. Our answer was that we're going to consider that as a possibility, and so we are somehow consulting on this matter. It has to do with Guatemala. It depends exactly what Guatemala will do. I think that after 35 rounds, it is important to have a different solution, and the Dominican Republic can be available if it is considered for the position. And this is as much as I can say, because there's a lot of consultation going on about this possibility.
The gentleman here. In the second row.
Alec Watson, president from Hills and Company and Dependent American Development Foundation.
Alec, we'll get you a microphone in just a second.
Mr. President, I'm Alec. Alec Watson from the Hills and Company and the Pan-American Development Foundation. I wonder if you could spend a few minutes talking about the relationship the Dominican Republic has with your neighbor country, Haiti, in addressing common problems and helping Haiti resolve some of its problems, which have an impact on the Dominican Republic as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, traditionally, there has been a situation of tension between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, historically. One of the complexities of our history is that the Dominican Republic did not obtain its independence from a European colonial power, but from its neighbor, from Haiti. And I think that has created a situation of permanent tension between both countries. But modern days, I think there are a couple of issues of common interest that both governments have been trying to solve since my previous administration and President Prevost, who have coincided in our two previous administrations. One has to do with migration, especially massive illegal Haitian migration into the Dominican Republic, which has created an image problem for the Dominican Republic internationally. Because there is, from my view, a false perception about Haitians in the Dominican Republic worldwide. Haitians are under inhumane conditions in Haiti. So when they migrate into the Dominican Republic, they find better conditions in the Dominican Republic than in Haiti. In the 60s, 70s, still the 80s, with the sugar industry still booming, they lived in the batelles, which were places specifically for the cane cutters, Haitian cane cutters. Now, with the decline of the sugar industry in the Dominican Republic and the whole Caribbean, there's a new profile of the Haitian migration into the Dominican Republic. And instead of being cane cutters, they're in different activities, different agricultural crops, rice, potatoes, tomatoes, etc. But essentially, they are working in the construction sector. They're very active in the construction sector. And very active in the construction sector in tourism. So we see Haitian population in the tourist areas in the Dominican Republic. I think there's a major change in the profile of this Haitian migration, which is better off today than it was before within the sugar industry. There's also trade between DR and Haiti, exports from the Dominican Republic into Haiti, which amounts over $100 million a year, which means is important for the Dominican Republic. I think it's our third trade partner after the U.S. And Spain. It is Haiti. There's border security, what I referred to before in terms of drug trafficking taking place at the border and is damaging tremendously the Dominican Republic with an increase in crime rate that we are addressing at this moment. So there are a whole set of issues, environmental degradation that has been taking place in Haiti over the years, and health issues, especially with HIV/AIDS. Haiti has the largest rate of HIV/AIDS in all Latin America, and that endangers the Dominican Republic. Health sanitation measurements that are not well taken care of in Haiti also has implications for the Dominican Republic. So there's a whole set of issues between Haiti and the Dominican Republic that has to be addressed on a bilateral matter with great responsibility from both governments. Now, Haiti by itself is unable to solve some of its internal domestic problems. So there is a need for the international community to sustain aid for Haiti. If you consider, Haiti's GDP amounts to $4 billion a year. Dominican Republic's is $32 billion a year. So Dominican Republic's GDP is eight times Haiti's. Dominican is seen as a modern country. When Haitians look at the Dominican Republic, it's like a reference model to them in terms of what a modern country is like. So Dominican Republic is like a magnet, an attraction for Haitians coming in. But What I insist is, first, you have to maintain order in Haiti, and you don't have the military there in place. And you have a police which is not well-trained, unfunded, cannot deal with public order in Haiti. Then the vision we have in the Dominican Republic is that the MINUSTAH forces should be there for some time in order to help Haiti manage its public order, domestic public order. And I think there needs to be disbursements from the multilateral organizations and from the U.S. government and Canada and France that have pledged aid to Haiti, that these funds should be delivered on time so that the new government can deliver on some of its promises and sustain the confidence and the support of the Haitian people in order to avoid social unrest or protest and upheavals there. So I think the relationship between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, in short, is very sensitive. It is very important for the Dominican Republic, but there is a need for the international community to understand that it needs to be there to sustain the governability in Haiti. Otherwise, it will be chaos. Otherwise, it will be unruled, and it will go back to a vicious circle with no end.
We have a question in the back.
Manuel Jiménez, del periódico Hoy de Santo Domingo. Bueno, mi pregunta va en inglés, digo en español. Estoy contagiado. Señor presidente, usted ha expuesto el proceso de transformación que está viviendo República Dominicana en estos momentos, de transformación económica, y también ha hablado de los retos que el país enfrenta fundamentalmente en materia...
Manda un poquito más que no escucho, sí.
Digo, usted ha hablado del proceso de transformación que vive República Dominicana y ha hablado también de los retos que la República Dominicana enfrenta fundamentalmente en materia de educación y de salud. Ahora se habla de una reforma fiscal y entonces el anuncio ha sido recibido con mucha reserva por parte de la población dominicana, que teme que en esto implique la imposición de nuevos impuestos. Lo que yo quiero preguntarle fundamentalmente es cómo se estructuraría esta nueva rectificación tributaria, como se le llama, de manera que las aprensiones que tiene ahora la población no resulten ser ciertas, o cómo se puede equilibrar esto para que, como siempre se sostiene, no se cargue más el dado a los sectores de menos ingresos.
Sí. Bueno, puedo responder en español, ¿verdad? Sí. Yo diría lo siguiente, Manuel, para entender esto en el contexto en que tiene que ser entendido. Yo he hablado aquí en el día de hoy acerca de las transformaciones que la sociedad dominicana ha experimentado en los últimos 40 años y que aún hoy día están teniendo lugar. Yo diría que en materia fiscal empezamos una gran transformación desde el año de 1991, con una reducción de aranceles y tratando de reorientar la política fiscal dominicana hacia ingresos internos. O sea que es un proceso que se inicia hace ya bastante tiempo. Ahora, ¿qué resulta? Que para la entrada en vigencia del DERE CAFTA, todavía teníamos que realizar una reforma fiscal, la que hicimos en octubre del año 2005, la más profunda reforma fiscal hecha en la República Dominicana, porque estaba orientada hacia una transformación de la naturaleza del sistema impositivo nacional. ¿En qué sentido? Menos dependiente de los ingresos aduanales para ser dependientes de ingresos fiscales internos. Es la más profunda y radical reforma fiscal que se ha hecho en toda la historia de la República Dominicana. Ahora bien, cuando se hizo, el gobierno advirtió que lo que el Congreso, entonces dominado por la oposición, quería hacer, iba a generar una reducción de ingresos equivalentes más o menos a 7,000 millones de pesos. El gobierno lo que estaba planteando en octubre del 2005 era una reforma compensatoria. Lo que se perdía por aduanas tenía que recaudarse por impuestos internos. Pero la oposición, entonces tratando de debilitar al gobierno, les redujo los ingresos en 7,000 millones de pesos, cosa que advertimos a tiempo. Justamente nuestra advertencia se ha cumplido. Ha habido merma en los ingresos. No ha habido exceso de gastos, reconocido por los organismos internacionales. República Dominicana no ha incurrido en indisciplina fiscal. Lo que ha habido es una reducción del ingreso sobre la base de que no se tomaron en cuenta medidas advertidas por nosotros. Una meta fundamental del país que hemos logrado en los últimos 2 años es garantizar la consolidación fiscal. Tenemos que garantizar el mantenimiento de ese balance fiscal. Entonces, lo que se está proponiendo no es nuevos impuestos o un paquetazo, como alguien ha dicho. Lo que se está planteando es una rectificación a lo que se hizo y respecto a lo cual se había advertido que si no se hacía así, iba a traer estas consecuencias. Entonces, no hay motivo para que nadie se sienta alarmado, para que nadie se sienta inquieto. Ya cuando regresemos a la República Dominicana, todo esto será explicado en detalle. Incluso hay una misión del Fondo Monetario Internacional que estará en la República Dominicana. Se va a reunir con los distintos sectores del país y se va a explicar exactamente de qué es lo que se trata. Para mantener la estabilidad, para mantener el crecimiento, se requiere consolidar la política fiscal en nuestro país. De lo contrario, volveríamos a una situación a la que no queremos volver, de inestabilidad y de incertidumbre. Entonces, para enfrentar los grandes retos de futuro, este es un primer paso inevitable. Y si con dos reformas tributarias previas crecimos el ajuste fiscal del año 2004, crecimos 9,3, y con el ajuste de octubre del 2005, ahora estamos creciendo a 10, que nadie se inquiete porque la economía dominicana va bien. Si cada vez que se ajusta la economía crece a 10, que se haga un ajuste todos los años.
Steve Landy, Manchester Trade. Congratulations on what we would say in baseball is the most improved player, moving from negative growth to Far East level growth and so on over a 2-year period.
Thank you.
And maybe you'll even get into the 20s before you leave office. I have a question about your desire to diversify your export markets and so on. Mm-hmm. In two parts. One, do you foresee negotiating a whole group of free trade agreements, perhaps worldwide, perhaps following the examples of Mexico and Chile? Do you foresee other kinds of negotiations, or yes, you see doing this mainly through simple export promotion and investment promotion? And specifically for Haiti, where we very much appreciated your comment and very much appreciate the support for passage of the HOPE bill, which hopefully will be passed during the lame duck session of Congress. Do you see the possibility of Haiti perhaps acceding to the DR-CAFTA agreement or the DR section of the DR-US free trade agreement and so on, since, as you know, HOPE has 3-year limits in terms of most of its provisions and so on? Would like to hear the answer to the question, and
right,
thank you again.
Thank you, yes. Well, the Dominican Republic is doing both things at the same time. We're negotiating some other free trade agreements with other countries, with Canada at this moment, with the European Union, and considering the possibility also of a free trade agreement with Taiwan. So we're moving forward in different areas there. At the same time, we'll try to diversify our production and exports. Up until now, as I said before, we have had agricultural products still there, sugar, coffee, the traditional exports. Also, a lot of textiles and apparel, footwear and plastics, some medical equipments that have been assembled in the Dominican Republic. But I think we should move into more high-tech and more value-added, as I said before, related to technologies. I think this is the future of the Dominican Republic. Now, related to Haiti, one of the major concerns for the economic sectors of any country when you deal with free trade is what will be the impact of liberalizing your markets and increasing your imports. Many of the local economic sectors consider this will ruin them. And a nation like Haiti, which depends specifically on agriculture is the most controversial issue in any free trade agreement, any free trade negotiation. Because of the subsidies here in the U.S. and in Europe, for example, which creates an asymmetrical trade, unfair trade. You can't subsidize agricultural production in an emerging economy. You don't have the resources to do that. And if a developed country subsidizes the production and export of agricultural products, so it's you double the asymmetrical relationship in this kind of trade. So for Haiti, I think it has a very fragile economy. Still, it needs to strengthen its production capacity. It needs to identify a strategy of competitiveness. Where does its comparative advantage lies? What is it going to gain through a free trade agreement? Haiti is more depending on aid, an international aid nowadays, and remittances from its nationals abroad than with the possibility of a free trade with any developed nation. Anyhow, this is just coming out of my head at this moment. I think it needs more deep thinking. But I think it needs to consolidate its production capacity nowadays, to diversify, to strengthen its institution, because when you talk about trade, it's not only trade. It's a comprehensive program where you need to strengthen your government institutions. The public sector must be transparent and must be reliable and accountable. And I think you need to go in Haiti more into an institution building capacity still at this moment, the way we see it. All right.
Thank you. One final question, sir.
Thank you. Richard Sudriat, president of IFES. Bienvenido, señor presidente.
Gracias, Richard. Muchas gracias.
Gracias a usted. I think we all were eager to hear about your, when you were talking about the efforts to consolidate democracy. It would be interesting to hear what your thoughts are in terms of what are some of the real concrete steps needed in order to move in that direction. The Dominican Republic over the last 40 years has had a number of elections. Unfortunately, they always seem to wind up with trauma, and often Monsignor Agrippino Nunez is called in to help mediate. What do you see as are the steps needed in order to put the country's political system on the right road? Thank you.
From the electoral perspective, I would say that the role of the electoral board, the role of the Junta Central Electoral, I think it's critical. Most of the trauma comes because people don't trust the members of the electoral board. And when you have an electoral board that doesn't have the confidence of the key political players and of the citizenship, there is a problem. What we're trying to promote is a new institutional mechanism for the selection of the members of the electoral board to guarantee independence from these members. Because if they belong to political parties, they have a conflict of interest. And this is what has been happening in the Dominican Republic in the last few elections, in the last three, four elections. So the need to, once again, strengthen the institutional mechanism to guarantee free and fair elections, and that comes from the electoral board. Now, who selects the members of the electoral board in the Dominican Republic? The Senate. And the Senate can be controlled by one of the parties. Right now, it is controlled by our party, the Dominican Liberation Party. Before, it was absolutely controlled by the Dominican Revolutionary Party. Now, our party can determine who will be the members of the electoral board, and we can decide it by ourselves if we wanted to. And that would be legally, that will be constitutional, that will be legitimate. But it will be politically unwise to do that, because you will not create the confidence that is needed to hold free and fair elections. So there needs to be some sort of consulting mechanism, bring the other players in, so everybody will feel comfortable with who is going to lead the electoral board. Now, this is because we have the democratic will to do that. We're not obliged to do it. What we're thinking is a reform in the Constitution to create a new institutional mechanism where all the parties will be obligated to select members of the board that can be trusted by everyone. And this will have to be a collective body where all the players participate in a negotiation that will enable to have a board trusted by everyone. Because the way the mechanism operates right now doesn't guarantee that. It depends very much on the will of who controls, who holds the majority of the seats in the Senate. And you can't have a political system dependable on the will of those who control the majority at any specific time. So we have to change the mechanism there. On the electoral side, the other thing has to do with the judiciary, the role of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court also controls the constitutionality of the laws in the Dominican Republic and the presidential decrees. There has been an extrapolation of the Madison versus Marbury case here in the States into the Dominican legal system, which doesn't exactly fit because we come from a more continental European legal system. Napoleon Code system is not the English common law system. So it doesn't fit, and it creates some difficulty in the separation of powers. You have the Supreme Court nullifying a presidential decree. So the Supreme Court comes above the executive branch of power. It doesn't fit within Dominican legal tradition. So we also have to see what is the role that the Supreme Court plays. There is an organ, it's called Consejo Nacional de la Magistratura, that selects the members of the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court selects the members of other judges. I think that it should be that way. I think el Consejo de la Magistratura should select all the judges at the different jurisdictions to make the system more workable, because otherwise judges at the first level would condition their decisions on what is being thought at the Supreme Court. So you don't have the independence of the different courts within the system unless you make it independent from the Supreme Court in the selective process. That's another major change I think needs to be made. So the constitutional reform that's been debated in the Dominican Republic at this moment will be a major contribution to guarantee of never reversing to an authoritarian regime, because any public official will be held accountable for violating human rights in the Dominican Republic. Any citizen whose rights are being violated can direct and file a claim in a jurisdiction court against any public official. And I think that's a permanent guarantee that democracy will not be reversed in the Dominican Republic. I think this will be the best contribution we've ever made to the consolidation of democracy in the Dominican Republic. So I think there are still some institutional aspects that must be addressed. We're doing it, but it is with the intention of consolidating democracy.
Mr. President, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, please remain seated until the President has departed. Let's thank the President for his